Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. And once again, I'm coming to you live on this Monday evening, May 30th. I'm hearing a little background noise. I don't know what that's from. I would like to speak tonight about a little follow-up from what I was speaking about last week. This is Carolyn Yeager again, coming to you live, and certain things do happen when we are live, I guess. Last week, I talked about the word Holocaust, and I explained why it was a word we should not use. I suggested we might substitute deportation, but I hadn't given it any real thought yet. Tonight, I suggest expulsion as a better choice. Deportation is too mild and won't be taken seriously. Expulsion is a strong word and most definitely describes what the Jews experienced. Expulsion is a painful process. There is no doubt about it. And when the German Wehrmacht and the Waffen-SS had to retreat from the areas they had won in the East, an expulsion of the German Volksdeutsche began, which numbered 14 million, of which 3 million perished, and the brutality was greater by far than that experienced by the Jews during their expulsion from German-occupied territory. Now, further, this was only the latest in many expulsions of Jews throughout history. Of course, they were expelled from Judea, part of the Roman Empire in the 8th and 1st centuries B.C., they were expelled from Britain in 1290 by King Edward I, and from Spain by Queen Isabella in 1492, and by many towns, provinces, and fiefdoms throughout Christian lands. So expulsion is nothing new, and this latest Jewish expulsion was not a unique event in history. So tonight I'm going to speak about another word that we, the white European community, have accepted and are using ourselves, which is, in fact, harmful to our interests. This word is racism. This is a misunderstood and misused term because it has been charged with meaning that it does not in itself have. In other words, it has become politicized. I think most people react more negatively to racism than they do to anti-Semitism. Now, you know, racism is actually a newly coined word from racialism. Wikipedia says racism is the belief that there are inherent differences in people's traits and capacities which are entirely due to their race. This is perfectly clear, is it not? I mean, we all know that this is true. There are differences, inherent differences in people in their traits and capacities, which are entirely due to their race. But this has become something that is denied by the left. And I'm going to explain more about that. But first, Wikipedia adds to this definition of racism that alternatively, it adds something which is purely political to this definition. Alternatively, racism is a practice of certain groups of people being treated differently, which is then justified by recourse to racial stereotyping or pseudoscience. Now, going to the word racialism at Wikipedia, it says it is the basic position that not only do races exist, but also that there are significant differences between them. Now, this racialism was the term and the word that was used up until around 1865 to 70 in France as part of all of the communist, well, it wasn't communist then, but part of the upheavals and revolutions going on in France during quite over a period of time. And this was where racialism was changed to racism. Now, in racialism, we just have significant difference between the races. This was something that was accepted from always, you can't even go back to when. It was always accepted. And it wasn't until recent times that this has been questioned and has been called pseudoscience. The term racialism on Wiki goes on to say, this is to be contrasted with racism, which also assumes that some races are superior to others. Well, I don't know that it assumes that. However, what it gives as the main reasons, the main differences among the races that are considered that one is superior to the others are skin color and IQ differences. Now, it's obvious that skin color is different, but it certainly is far more than skin color. And we also know that there are IQ differences between the races. But this is where the problem comes up and where we are not allowed to say that anymore because there is a desire to put across the idea that there is no difference among the races and that even though there is black, yellow, red, or black, yellow, white races, we are to see that as they are sub-races. There's only a human race, they say, and these others are sub-races. Well, I say, what difference does it make if they're sub-races? That's all right. So you say there's a human race and it's divided into three major sub-races. We still have a difference between them, the same thing. So now, the vital question is it possible to understand and accept IQ differences without encouraging inferior superior feelings? This is the crux of the problem that is seen by the left, that you're going to create a superiority idea of one over the other. Now, because of what I've just said, I think we need to stop accepting the word racism or racist, because it doesn't have a clear or intelligent meaning. It has a political meaning. You are charged with being a bad person if you are a racist or if you believe in racism. So we should quit using that word. We should quit accepting that word. I'm going to go into that a little bit more. And we should use instead racialism, which is still not considered a good word. But it is more accurate. Now let me tell you about how the word racism got started. In the late 18th century, in France, the monarchy and associated institutions were overthrown in the French Revolution, which forever changed French and world history. The country was governed for a period as a republic until the French Empire was declared by Napoleon Bonaparte. Following Napoleon's defeat in the Napoleonic Wars, France went through further regime changes, being ruled as a monarchy, then briefly as a republic, and then as a second empire until a more lasting Third French Republic was established in 1870. Now, this was at the time of the French-German War with Bismarck, and in March 1871, new municipal elections were held in Paris, in which 229,000 Parisians voted. Now, it was also 1871 that Germany was unified under Bismarck, and who was a Prussian, and it became a kind of a German-Prussian empire. This was a good thing as far as the Germans were concerned, but obviously it was not a good thing, especially as far as the British were concerned. But what was happening in Paris was that they held, because of their defeat, they had a new French Republic, established, and now they had some elections. And from the first, the new government of Paris reflected something totally new. The Industrial Revolution in France had been in full bloom for some time, but consequently, a large number of Paris citizens who came out in the streets in revolt and who subsequently formed the new government of the Paris Commune were working class citizens who worked for wages in the factories in the city. This was a big change that took place, and of course this was a big part of the revolution taking place, the left-wing revolution taking place in France. These working class citizens directed the tone of the government of the Paris Commune, this is what it was called, commune, in a way that represented working class interests. Thus, the government of the Paris Commune, the Paris Commune became the first proletarian revolution in history. The government was divided, but the political divisions were totally new to the political scene. The minority opposition within the communard government were anarchists and followers of Proudhon. As anarchists, they supported limited or no government and wanted the revolution to follow an ad hoc course with little or no planning. So we had the proletarian, we had the working class, and some were for a strong government representing the working class, I take it, a la communist style. And then some others, but a smaller group, were the anarchists who wanted the same kind of working class rights, but they didn't want government to be planning and controlling their lives in any way. But in any case, during that time, the word racism came into use. Now, I can't give you any more details on that because it's not clear, but that it says, I have found that racism originated in 1865 to 1870 as a French word, racisme, or R-A-C-I-S-M-E in French. Naturally, it's a part of the Marxist-Leninist lingo, the Communist-Internationalist lingo. It took the reality of racialism and turned it into a negative, a hatred. Supposedly, if you had any ideas of race, you had a hatred of outsiders, Jews, foreigners, who were directing revolutionary activities inside France. And today, the word racist has evolved into an epithet. And my concern here tonight is that our own people condemn racism along with the people on the left. Now, why do they do that? Well, actually, some of them sympathize with a lot of left causes and left thinking. But a lot are confused in what they actually stand for. They've been confused by that word because it is part of the propaganda that's going on all the time, and just about everyone has fallen for this idea that racism is a terrible thing. And also, many of our people, along with sympathizing with left causes and left thinking and left lingo, they want to appear kind and good. That's all. That's all part of the left. You know, not being for everyone and not against anyone. And they're also, though, fooled by words. I have been watching this and sort of complaining about it here and there for a couple of years already, particularly as racism is applied to the Jews of Israel or about Israel or to Jews in general. And I think that our people who are doing this and thinking they're doing a good thing are doing great damage to the cause for truth, because being anti-racist doesn't represent the truth. Our people, especially Holocaust revisionists, love to point to Jewish racism as proof of Jewish iniquity. They think, you know, see, this is where they think, Jewish racism, my gosh, oh yeah, those Jews, they're racist. And then they point to that as to show how bad they are. This is a big mistake. Does this help us? No. We are shooting ourselves in the foot. And I'm going to explain more. It is not Jewish racism that is the problem, But Jewish violence, Jewish crime, Jewish behavior, that's really true. The Jews can be as racist as they want. They have always been racist. Their philosophy of the chosen people, they are the chosen of God, they are superior. They've always believed that. And there is no reason why we should care that they believe that or don't believe that. They can be as racist as they want. What we do care about is their behavior. And what they are guilty of is violent behavior, criminal behavior. And it doesn't matter what their thinking is about race. Should we care if they're racist? As I've already said, that, you know, they've always had these beliefs, and actually it's their right to believe what they want, just like we have a right to believe, because this is criminalizing belief when you criminalize people who think in racial terms. Now, in doing this, we're playing into their hands. I've only got a few minutes left. I've got to hurry here. We're playing into their hands. Most of our people are not smart enough to figure that out, I'm sorry to say. We promote the left agenda and unlimited immigration by doing this, which is our own destruction. Those who think they're smart and they're doing the right thing about this racism word are duped. They are approving, recommending, and promoting these very leftists who stand against us and promote the things that are damaging to our future. So now, an example I want to give of this kind of a confusion is Christopher John Bjerknes, his website. He has a website. It's titled Jewish Racism. And so many of our people, and I say our people kind of loosely because I don't know what else to call them, but who supposedly are on our side, just think this is great. They love to talk about Jewish racism, and they think Bjerknes is a friend in some way. He's helping us do our job. He's attacking the Jews. No, you know, right at the top of his website, right next to his heading, Jewish Racism, are the words in bold type, dedicated to protecting all Jews from the anti-Semitism and inhumanity of racist Jews. Racist Jews. Dedicated to protecting all Jews from the anti-Semitism and inhumanity of racist Jews. What is he saying? He is saying very clearly that only some Jews are racist. Most aren't. Where we know that the Jewish religion itself is a racialist religion based on race. Now, racism, he is saying in this also that racism is an evil. And it's an evil directed at Jews. Because he says we have to protect all Jews from the few racist Jews. So now why do whites cheer this and read this and recommend this site? This site is for Jews. But unthinking whites take any criticism of Jews, no matter how it is worded, as a positive for us. This is wrong. This is wrong. Christopher John Bjerknes is not a friend of ours. He is a friend of the Jews. And he is trying to point out, he's trying to sacrifice a few Jews in order to save all the rest of the Jews. But more importantly, he is trying to condemn racism. This is the main overall theme that goes on that we must understand not to join in with, condemning racism. Now, further on in his site, he calls racism, he has this little motto or slogan or something. It's segregation, supremacy, slaughter. So he is using the term segregation as the beginning point. And you see how segregation, he says, leads to superior, inferior thinking, leads to supremacy. And supremacy leads to slaughter. Is this right? Does segregation eventually lead to slaughter? Of course not. Of course not. That is nonsense thinking. I can think of worse words for it, but that simply is wrong. It's trying to create this idea that if you want to be segregated, which I think everybody has that right. If that is what they believe and that is how they feel, they have a right to express that. They have a right to try to do that for those who agree with them. There is no reason, you know, why this should be turned into some kind of an evil. It's turned into an evil because the communist desire to wipe out all differences between people, nations, races, ethnicities, and make everyone, you know, in one wonderful diverse world of diversity in which differences become sublimated and eventually disappear. So this is what's going on here. And every one of you who are talking about condemning racism, and I see it everywhere, and I could name some names, but I'm not going to do it. But there are our friends, and there are many Holocaust revisionists who do this and join in with this, and they have no idea what they're doing. And even if they listen to what I just said and listen carefully to it, I think many of them would still disagree. They would come up with their little reasons, which to me are lacking in solid thinking and solid reasoning. But there you are. That's what they believe in, that's what they want to continue to do. So what are we going to do about this problem we have with words? We have three words that are really, we really need to reject: Holocaust, anti-Semite, and racist. All three of these, and I don't know which one is the most important, but racist is very, very important to understand and not to condemn. And we need to express every time it comes up what racism really is, and that it really shouldn't be called racism. It should be called racialism, the belief in the difference in things. So, that's I'll be back in a
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Britain is stepping up pressure on Colonel Gaddafi by deploying a Pache attack helicopters in Libya, armed with bunker-busting bombs. So it comes as NATO's chief says the Libyan leader's reign of terror is nearing an end. But as artist Laura Emmett reports, the UK's decision seems to be moving far beyond mere humanitarian objectives.
An inexorable trend towards escalation. That's what analysts are calling British involvement in the Libya conflict, as the UK prepares to send in Apache attack helicopters.
They can fly low, they can fly slow, and so they can hit targets that fast jets cannot hit from the air. They also involve a fair amount of risk. They can be shot down much more easily than a fast jet, so the possibility of NATO personnel being captured on the ground has just gone up.
The Apaches, which will be joined by a contingent of French helicopters, can maneuver in built-up areas and attack fairly small targets. They'll make it easier to take out arms stores and target places where Colonel Gaddafi may be hiding. It's part of Prime Minister David Cameron's strategy to turn up the heat in Libya.
They seem to think that if they quote the UN resolution at the same time as they call for Gaddafi to go in for regime change, it's a kind of like a guarantee, a sort of laissez-faire. I mean, frankly, they're involved in a civil war in Libya. The deployment of helicopters, Apache helicopters there, the intensive bombing of Tripoli that's going on, this is a war about regime change.
The helicopters mark only the latest escalation of this conflict. Following the no-fly zone, NATO sent in advisers to train the rebels, introduced drone patrols, and by the first week of May had flown nearly 6,000 strike sorties, with Tripoli subjected to the heaviest bombing. A recent YouGov poll for the Sun tabloid newspaper showed less than half of Britons now support the intervention in Libya, but that number's likely to plummet once UK troops are in significantly more danger.
Just wait, if a helicopter crashed and God forbid we lose 10 people, if that happened, we started being blown out of the sky, don't even think about it. So the issue is, we haven't dropped any blood. Yeah, we've dropped tens of millions of pounds, which we haven't got, but not one single one of our people has died. When that happens, the game and the PR game will change.
People have marched against the Libya war here in the UK, but in small numbers compared to the million that marched ahead of the invasion of Iraq. But helicopters bring the fighting closer to the ground, and with it, a higher risk of death and angry opposition at home. The government might be able to defend that as long as the new strategy makes rapid progress. But if it doesn't, many see the next step as troops on the ground in clear defiance of the UN resolution that allowed the original no-fly zone.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, live this Memorial Day night, and I want to turn my attention now to the subject of the British creation of Israel. Who did more to bring about the state of Israel? The Jews, the British, or the Nazis? Many dunderheads claim it was Hitler. The ridiculous book, Adolf Hitler, Founder of Israel, is one which has influenced many people. This book is pure garbage and gossip. Now, why do so many people like this kind of thing? I can't answer that, and it's disturbing. But it's true, they like anything that's full of gossip and lots of stuff tearing into people, particularly, you know, well-known people, and it fits in with various agendas that they have. But I'm going to make the case here with real live events that it is the British who get to wear the crown for this accomplishment, not Hitler. Now, speaking about British Jews, the Board of Deputies of British Jews is maybe one of the largest associations or organizations of Jews in Britain. I don't know if it is, but it might be. It's the main representative of British Jews, though, and it's considered to be their main representative body. And it was founded in 1760. Think about that, as a joint committee of the Sephardi Jews, which are the Spanish and Portuguese, and the Ashkenazi Jews, which are the Central and Eastern European, and in London. So in 1760, the Jews were strong enough in London to found this organization. And going back a little bit, in 1656, Oliver Cromwell made it clear that the ban on Jewish settlement would no longer be enforced. So that is when Jews were first allowed to return to Britain, because as I had said, I may not have gotten around to saying it, but the Jews were expelled from Britain in 1290 by King Edward I. But in 1656, Oliver Cromwell said, well, he was not going to enforce this ban any longer. And here's something else. In 1846, it took 200 years although I'm sure it was also not enforced, but there was a British law which prescribed a special dress for Jews, and that was repealed in 1846. This law was called De Judaismo, but, you know, they had this. Why did the British have a law of Jews having to wear a special dress? So that they could be identified. Think in terms of the yellow star of David, which often wasn't even yellow, that or even a star that Jews wore to identify themselves in Germany and German-occupied areas, certain ones, not all, mostly in Poland was where it started, in order to, that they could be identified. Later, it took that was prescribed in Berlin. Goebbels wanted that done because there were so many Jews and they were hiding around and doing things, and he wanted to have to Jews to be able to be identified. And but this was in Britain long before that, and it wasn't repealed until 1846. But I'm sure it had not been enforced all during that time at all. Now, another little factoid, about two-thirds of United Kingdom's Jews live in Greater London. Now, it says United Kingdom. Two-thirds of all the Jews in the United Kingdom live in Greater London, or contiguous parts of South Herefordshire and Southwest Essex. Now, so that shows that the great strength of Jews in London, and of course London rules the United Kingdom, and London the city and all of that. Now, I'm going to turn my attention here to Sir Moses Montefiore. He is a notable past president of this British, the Board of Deputies of British Jews. And he was one of the early presidents. He was in the, he lived from 1835, no, he was president from 1835 to 1874. He lived from 1784 to 1885. Now, he was very important, and he was president of this Board of Deputies from 1835 to 1874. I mean, we're talking about 40 years he was. And he traveled around the world assisting Jews facing persecution. Now, a more recent president of the this Board of Deputies is Greville Janner, who I have spoken about, who is the child molester who became Lord Janner. Now, but preceding him in this position was his father, who also became a lord, Lord Barrett Janner. He was in office from 55 to 64. Greville Janner was president from 78 to 84. Now, I mention these people because I want you to get an idea of the kind of people who are running things in the amongst the British Jews, some pretty questionable people. The current president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews is Vivian Weinman. But back to Moses Montefiore. He was a financier, banker, philanthropist. Guess, you know, aren't they all? Aren't they all? Financier and banker. And even he became Sheriff of London. Now, I'm gonna tell you first, as president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, he had a lot of correspondence with the British consul in Damascus, whose name was Charles Henry Churchill. And this particular correspondence that's very important was in 1841 and 42 and is seen as pivotal to the development of Proto-Zionism. More about that in a minute. Now, first, how did Moses get to Britain? Well, his grandfather, Moses Vita Montefiore, emigrated from Livorno, Italy, to London in the 1740s. Now, our Moses, his name was Moses Haim Montefiore, lived to be over 101. And on his 100th birthday, it was celebrated as a national event in Britain and by Jews all over the world. Now, this was in 1884, as I said. So in 1884, this Jew was, his 100th birthday was celebrated as a national event in Britain. Moses was 6 feet 3 inches tall, which somehow has, made him into a very impressive figure to all and seemed to have contributed to the esteem in which people held him because he was so imposingly tall. But more about him, he married, this is also typical, he married Judith Cohen in 1812. Her sister was Henriette, who was the wife of Nathan Meyer Rothschild. And when Moses married Judith Cohen and became related to the Rothschilds, he then acted as stockbroker for this Rothschild. And only 12 years later, in 1824, he retired a very rich man and devoted himself to philanthropy. Isn't that nice? Now, his philanthropy, though, was all for Jews, as they all are. He donated large sums of money to promote industry, education, and health amongst the Jewish community in Palestine, including the founding of the first settlement in Palestine. And he was a believer in Eretz Israel, as they all were. He was obviously then a Zionist, and he was knighted by Queen Victoria. Queen Victoria knighted him for his help with the Jews. It says he received a baronetcy in 1846 in recognition of his humanitarian efforts on behalf of the Jews. So the British thought so much of Jews that helping Jews around the world was considered worthy of British titles. And they're still getting British titles based on all the work they do solely for Jews and promoting Jews and Jewish interests. Or is it really for that reason? Or is it about money and banking? You know, all these Jews that get all this attention, they are very big in the money and financial and banking world, which is the source of British power, was at that time, still is, or maybe it is, and was all important. So this explains a lot. Now, going to this Churchill, Charles Henry Churchill, Colonel Charles Henry Churchill, was a British consul in Ottoman Syria. You know, this was all the Ottoman Empire here in the Middle East, who created the first political plan for Zionism. This is what it says officially, and the creation of the State of Israel in the region of the Ottoman Palestine in the early 1840s. Churchill proposed a strategy for the creating of a Jewish state predating formal Zionism by approximately half a century. Now, who was this Churchill? He was the grandson of George Spencer Churchill, the 5th Duke of Marlborough. His parents were Lord Charles Spencer Churchill and Ethelred Catherine Bennett. Charles Henry married Rosalie Lowther, but he was, here's the deal, he was the first cousin of John Spencer Churchill, 7th Duke of Marlborough, the grandfather of Winston Churchill. So he was a cousin to Winston Churchill. They were therefore closely related in the very same family line that came of Churchill family line. And in 1841, this Charles Henry Churchill wrote to Montefiore. And here's some quotes from his letter. "I cannot conceal from you my most anxious desire to see your countrymen endeavor once more to resume their existence as a people. I consider the object to be perfectly attainable, but two things are indispensably necessary. Firstly, that the Jews will themselves take up the matter universally and unanimously. Secondly, that the European powers will aid them in their views." Now, what is he doing here? He's telling this Montefiore, who's so interested in promoting and helping the Jews and in building up Jews in Palestine, that he so much wants to aid in that, and he wants the Jews to take this up and to get excited about it. And then the European powers will help them. But the Jews first have to say, "We want this, we want this." See, he goes on. Here's a further quote. "I have prepared a rough petition, which will be signed by all the Jews here," meaning in Ottoman Syria, "and in other parts of Syria, and which I shall then forward to you. Probably 2 or 3 months will elapse first. There are many considerations to be weighed and examined as the question develops itself, but a beginning must be made, a resolution must be taken, and an agitation must be commenced. And where the stake is, country and home, he says, where is the heart that will not leap and bound to the appeal? So this is not the Jews clamoring to the British to give them something in Palestine, you know, larger and more official. This is the British. This is some among the British most elite families. Churchill was, and offering to the Jews and saying, if you will, you know, if you will exert yourself to make a demand for this, then we'll be more than happy to help you out with it. That's the way I see it. Now there is that was about the Board of Deputies. Now another Jewish organization was called the Jewish Colonization Association, and this was formed in 1891 by the Baron Maurice de Hirsch. Its aim was to facilitate the mass immigration of Jews from Russia and other Eastern European countries by settling them in agricultural colonies on lands purchased by the committee, particularly in North and South America, especially Argentina and Brazil. Now, London was very involved in this also. Now, colonies were also funded, though I need to continue with this, were also funded within the United States in southern New Jersey, Ellington, Connecticut, and elsewhere. And a Canadian committee of the Jewish Colonization Association was established in November 1906 to assist in the settlement of thousands of Jewish refugees fleeing Russia and to oversee the development of all the colony settlements in the country. They formed colonies in 8 colonies in Saskatchewan, 4 in Manitoba, 2 in Quebec, 2 in Alberta. And some of them didn't last beyond the end of World War II, you see, because, of course, by the end of World War II, they didn't need this. They were in like Flynn. And they disbanded these supposedly agricultural colonies because they didn't want to do agriculture, but they stayed in Canada and in Argentina and Brazil and everything where they were and went on to bigger and better things. But now, this Baron de Hirsch, his grandfather was the first Jewish landowner in Bavaria. His father was banker to the Bavarian king. Now, Bavaria at that time was an independent state, and his grandfather, of course, being bankers, helping these elites with their money, that's how they got in. Now, at 13, Hirsch was sent to Brussels to school. He went into business at the age of 17, where, with the banking, he was eventually associated with the banking house of Bischoff, Scheim, and Goldschmidt, a Jewish banking house in Brussels, London, and Paris. He left Germany behind. He was now, you know, in Brussels, London, and Paris. He amassed a large fortune, naturally, which he increased by purchasing and working railway concessions in Austria, Turkey, and the Balkans, and by speculations in sugar and copper. Now, I ask you, how many of you, certainly not me, and how many of ordinary people or people that we, you know, understand, have any opportunity to work railway concessions and make a bundle of money? They're not. Who can do this? These Jewish banking houses, and then these promising young Jews of good family go and are apprenticed in these banking houses, and then they learn how to do all this, and then they're making a fortune off of the everyday people speculating in commodities and so on. Now, this Baron de Hirsch lived in great splendor in Paris, where he owned a townhouse on the Rue de l'Elysée, and he also had the Chateau de Beauregard. He had residences in London and Hungary, so I think maybe they came from Hungary. Maybe they were Hungarian Jews in the beginning. And, of course, Hungary, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the capital was Vienna, and perhaps they were Viennese Jews, actually, and then went to Bavaria, and then from then on to Paris and London. Now, you know, this Baron de Hirsch, he married the daughter of one of the Bischofsheim family. Now, I told you the banking house was Bischofsheim and Goldschmidt. He married Clara Bischofsheim, who was the daughter of Senator Bischofsheim of Brussels. But he also went into philanthropy, but only for the Jews. He devoted much of his time to schemes for the relief of his Hebrew co-religionists in lands where they were persecuted and oppressed. And there was all this talk around these times of the terrible oppression of the Jews in Russia. And we know that there were all these newspaper articles naming even 6 million Jews were going to die, 6 million Jews were starving, etc., etc. And there's a big deal made about all the starving, persecuted Jews in Russia and how they needed to be helped. And that's what these people were using to get Jews situated all around the world. Russian Jews. These are some of the worst Jews there are, Russian Jews. And as I have said, and I believe most Jews are originally from Russia. Jews basically are from the area of Russia. Now, at least the Ashkenazi. So, the Jewish now another organization was the Jewish Territorial Organization, which arose in 1903. And this was in response to the British Uganda offer. Now, what was that? This was an offer first made by another British colonialist, the Colonial Secretary Joseph Chamberlain, to Theodore Herzl's Zionist group of 5,000 square miles of the Mao Plateau in what is today Kenya and Uganda. So now, you know, they had colonized that area, so they could just give land away as they saw fit. This offer was a response to pogroms against the Jews in Russia. And it was hoped that the area could be a refuge from persecution for the Russian Jews. Now, the pogroms. Now, I want to tell you about the pogrom. What was it? In April of 1903, called Kishinev, Bessarabia, a western province of the Russian Empire, a local newspaper accused the region's Jews of killing a Christian child as part of their Passover rituals. This sparked a three-day pogrom, which resulted in the death of over 40 Jews. Just think, 40 Jews, 40 Jews died, as well as destruction and looting of Jewish homes and businesses. Well, now, this upset the world so much, and this upset a British Jew named Israel Zangwill, who then started this organization, Jewish Territorial Organization, because the British had offered this place in Uganda in response to this pogrom in Kishinev, Bessarabia. Now let's compare Kishinev to what happened to the Germans in Poland in 1939, which has been completely swept under the rug and denied and forgotten about. 58,000 Germans living in Poland, they were Germans who had been living in Germany until after World War I, you know, and then this parts, these Germans were, this territory was added to the new nation, a new territory, new whatever it was called, Republic of Poland, which hadn't existed before, and now they were a part of Poland, not anything that they were wishing for, but that's where they were stuck, and the Poles were persecuting them from the beginning. But during 1939, not just in September when Poland was invaded, but all during 1939 and up until February 1940, 58,000 Germans living in Poland were dead or missing. And now compare that to the 40 Jews in Kishinev. And these Germans in Poland included children, young women. They were brutally mutilated. This was the case where these people were found crucified against barns, even children nailed up to barn walls or posts here and there. Young women with their breasts cut off, raped, men mutilated, their testicles cut off, and stuffed in their mouth, and just the most horrible corpses you can imagine. Now the Poles had been doing this, and they got carried away with it even more so in later 1939 and early 1940. And even though, but the world didn't care about that, okay? The British didn't care about it, but they did care about these 40 Jews in Russia. So, to continue, I have only a few more minutes. Theodor Herzl hoped for a Jewish homeland in Palestine, but when he realized that things weren't quite going that way at that time, he accepted this British proposal for the creation of a Jewish colony in Africa. And Zangwill said, well, it wasn't what he wanted in the long term, but he'd go along with it for a short-term solution because it was so important to help these Russian Jews get out of Russia. And but when they held the Zionist conference in 1903, the World Zionist Organization did not support the Uganda scheme, and particularly those representatives from Eastern Europe who argued that Palestine was the only acceptable site. The Eastern Europe Jews were the most virulent and always have been, still are, and they would only accept Palestine. And Herzl was severely criticized for his willingness to accept a Jewish state outside of the Middle East. So, but this ITO went on until 1943. Naturally, by 1943, it was no longer necessary at all. So let me just say that this is just a little bit of research to show that we can trace the beginning of the British involvement with giving the Jews settlement rights in Palestine all the way back to 1841-42 with this Charles Henry Churchill, who was encouraging it. And the Jewish settlements were already there when Adolf Hitler decided to cooperate with the Zionists in transferring German Jews with most of their property and money to Palestine. He didn't dream it up. He didn't establish the Jews there. This had been going on for a long time, and he used it as an acceptable place to move German Jews to, which they would willingly, or at least the Zionists said they would, and the Zionists helped to encourage them to go there. So the it looks like my time is up, and thank you for listening tonight. I hope I've got something across to you, and I hope to be back next time. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.